Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, October 5th, 2009, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
You are one of the finest men I have ever met. You are wise. But there's a sadness to your wisdom.
Well, I don't know about that. What I can say for sure is that I am your host, ma'am, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. You know, it's National Coming Out Week, y'all. And to celebrate, I welcome back that genius of the comics world, Howard Cruz. He's here to finish the chat we began last Monday as part of the Erotic Mind podcast series, don't you know? Howard is a national treasure. His unique historical perspective on this amazing art form, one that spans from the rise of the underground comic movement in the 1960s right through to today, is both exciting and thought-provoking.
You're something special. You know that?
Why is everyone being so nice to me today? Is it possible that you missed part one of this conversation? Lucky for you, it resides in my podcast archive. To find it, use my site's search function. All you do is type in podcast 156 and presto. But don't forget to include the pound sign when you do the search. Be sure to check out the amazing world of Howard Cruz, including his personal blog, on his site, howardcruz.com. Today's podcast sponsor is, once again, So Hard. So Hard is what we in the business call a boner pill. But So Hard is not just any old Viagra knockoff, no siree. It's a pure, all-natural herbal formula that improves sexual health, combats erectile dysfunction, and increases the strength of your erection when aroused. Listen, I've tried So Hard, so I can testify to its effectiveness. Look for my review of So Hard on my product review site, DrDickSexToyReviews.com. Use the site's search function, type in So Hard, and you can read my comments and evaluation. Here's a tip. SoHardOnline.com is offering a special deal for a limited time. Buy 4 2-capsule packets and get the 5th packet free. Get your wood the natural way. Look for their handsome banner in the sidebar of my site. You'll be so glad you did.
It's been my experience that the more you think about it, the more you probably should worry. Because all men are pigs.
Well, you'll get no quarrel from me, ma'am. Okay, on with the show. Howard, welcome back, and thank you again for coming by DrDickSexAdvice.com. We were talking very intensely and intently last week about the early gay liberation movement that both you and I experienced as younger men. And I'd like to pick up precisely at that point. You were mentioning that the swirl of the gay liberation movement was happening around you. You knew that you were gay, at least to some degree. Then there was a coming out experience for you. But this was a personal coming out. This was not necessarily a professional coming out. Is that true?
Right. It was my intention to come out professionally, that is to say, to make public that I was gay.
Uh-huh.
I think any person with a brain in their head who read my story, Gravy on Gay, which came out in 1976, and which one of my central characters in the Barefoot series came out of the closet, anyone would know that it's very unlikely that a straight artist would be motivated to do that story. But I didn't actually declare myself for another few years.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know a good way to do that. And then Dennis Kitchen, the publisher of the now gone but much missed Kitchen Sink comics and Kitchen Sink books, and Dennis had been the main publisher of my work for ever since the early 70s.
Yeah.
And in 1979, he asked me if I would be the editor of a new series called Gay Comics, in which would be an anthology series using gay men and lesbians. And he, like me, was interested in having stories that were more reality-based and about the kind of emotions that everyday people had, as opposed to something campy and outrageous.
Right.
And I thought this was a perfect occasion for me to come out, because what I did want to do was somehow or other say, oh, I have this deep, dark secret, and now I'm going to reveal it to the world, and I'm gay, you know, with the overtones of confession.
Yes.
About it. And simply, when I started Gay Comics, we sent out a letter to every cartoonist, every underground cartoonist we knew, since I didn't know who was gay, and essentially said, we're going to put out this comic, I'm going to edit it, it's going to be called Gay Comics, and if you're not gay, but know some gay cartoonists, please pass this letter on to them. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know that it's a big risk to do that, and it's scary, and as a gay person myself, I know those fears.
Wow.
It was important, I think, if I was going to be the editor of Gay Comics, to make it clear that I was gay, because otherwise
yes.
people would not have trusted me. I certainly would not have put myself in the hands of someone that I felt like would be viewing me as an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And so that provided a good occasion. And it was a huge turning point in my own work, because for the first time after that, I could totally let down my guard and draw comics that reflected my, you know, my personal self, including, you know, my personal sexual fantasies and how it, you know, the kind of life I was leading. I didn't have to sort of maintain this feeling that maybe I'm a straight guy drawing this, that essentially you are rewarded for in, you know, publishing in general and in underground comics in particular, where there was this kind of macho attitude that prized, you know, comics that with athletic heterosexual right. sex all the time and stuff
yeah.
like that. And if you didn't say otherwise, you were assumed to be straight.
Right.
And I just felt relieved mm-hmm. to not have any pretenses going anymore.
And there was no going back on that. Once you're out, you're out. And as you say, there is that sense of personal freedom and no more prevarication and, you know, subtext and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it frees up a whole lot of psychic energy for, you know, getting on with the rest of one's life.
Exactly. When I was in college, I had a moment that was sort of parallel to that. In Birmingham, there was, you know, one major gay bar, and when I started going to the gay bar, I was out to some close friends and my little circle of theater people, which, of course, there were a number of gay people mm-hmm. In that group. But essentially, as far as the general campus was concerned, you know, I was perceived, assumed to be straight.
Mm-hmm.
And so one, you know, Saturday night or something, I was sitting around with a bunch of gay friends at this gay bar. And lo and behold, one of the fraternities at Birmingham Southern had decided that it would be amusing to go in en masse to the gay bar
mm-hmm.
and see what that was like. And so this troop of people, all of whom I had felt invested in not knowing that I was gay, you know, I just happened to look over my shoulder and there they all were.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been kind of a nightmare thought of that sort of thing happening, but I felt greatly relieved. I felt, well, okay, that it'll be all over the grapevine at school, and you know, I just don't need to worry about it anymore. I'll just assume that anybody knows I'm gay,
right?
And it made life a lot easier.
Oh, it certainly does. And you know, we talked last week about the research that I did at the same time that you were doing your comics. I was writing my dissertation on the sexual attitudes and behaviors of gay Catholic priests. And interestingly enough, I had to do the same thing. I had to send out letters and, you know, means of introducing myself to prospective priests who might be interested in talking to me about their sexual attitudes and behaviors. And I had to identify myself as gay because I didn't want them to think, well, you know, here is this, you know, anonymous priest who is now asking you to disclose yourself and your sexuality. So I had to do what I asked my participants to do, and that I had to do it first. So it's a very interesting kind of
thing. Exactly. It's a matter of you know, taking the same risks you're asking your followers to take.
That's right. Can you tell me something? We talked several times, or we've mentioned this several times, the word underground comics. What designates a comic to be underground?
Well, basically, it's an obsolete term now. It's a historic.
Yes.
During the period leading up to the 60s, comics had become a very self-censoring medium in response to scandal-mongering among a particular psychiatrist who went on a binge. Frederick Wortham was his name, and he wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent, which accused comics of, just comics themselves, mm-hmm. is inherently as having all sorts of bad impact on kids. And there was congressional talk of imposing censorship on comics. And to fend that off, the mainstream comics industry got together and established the Comics Code Authority, so that any comic in order to have it sealed, you had to pass inspection by a board, and there were a lot of rules, including things like you could not have homosexuality. I mean, that was the least of them. You couldn't say anything negative about a authority figure. It totally created this controversy-free realm for comics that dumbed them down.
Right.
And this was the state of affairs, and it's the kind of thing that made people who were interested in being serious artists in the comics field, made them say that it was hopeless, because, you know, what could you do if you had to look over your shoulder that someone was going to oppose you if you said anything controversial? Well, then came the counterculture, and then you had a whole bunch of kids in rebellion and doing psychedelic drugs and feeling free. And one of the forms of freedom that the cartoonists had was they wanted to be able to just draw comics about all the crazy things that were going on in their lives, including the sexual revolution.
Right.
And so underground comics just sort of sprang up from a few cartoonists who started doing it and a few publishers who started publishing them. And they were only sold to adults. They tried to forestall the whole notion of corrupting kids by selling them only to adults, and they were not
already corrupted.
Right. They were not through newsstands or drugstore racks or any of the places where mainstream comics were. They were usually sold in head shops and places that hippies went to.
Yes, on 8th Street. That's where I first saw them.
Well, exactly. Well, at the time that I really got most interested in them, I was living in Atlanta, and there was a head shop near my house, and I basically just went through the rack of underground comic books that were being published and recognized that this was a whole different ballgame from the way comics had been before, and it became very attractive to me to draw with that kind of freedom. Now, there was trying not to get bogged down in history, but there was a very unfortunate Supreme Court ruling on the subject of obscenity in 1973 that changed the rules. Before that, essentially, if a high court ruled a book as not obscene, that was the end of the argument in terms of its ability to be sold in the United States. But the rules were changed so that a book could be not obscene in one community and obscene in another community.
Oh, I know.
And it all depended on the local community. And so a prosecutor in Kansas could prosecute someone for publishing something that was perfectly acceptable within the mores of New York City or San Francisco.
Right.
And the result of that was another form of self-censorship. Basically, head shops dared not sell them because local prosecutors could come and, have them
close down the whole shop.
Close down the shop or have to pay huge bills, which in effect would close down the whole shop. Mm-hmm. So they became afraid to carry them. And you never stopped having a market for them, and you never stopped having people who wanted to draw them, but the line of distribution was cut for a while, and there was no way to get the comics to the people. But fortunately, there was reemergence as the 70s wore on, a cautious reemergence of underground comics. And there was also a greater tolerance. By then, you had the direct market of comic book shops. Before that, you hadn't had comic book shops, mm-hmm. some of who would carry underground comics and take the risks involved. And bit by bit, the idea of comics worthy of the attention of adults that were relatively uncensored came back in force, but it was not as oriented around overt celebration of taboos. And they were not called underground. They were called, these days they're called alternative comics, right, or indie comics, independent comics. And these still exist, and many of them will have material that's as sexual or outrageous or controversial as any undergrounds did. But the big difference is that there is no counterculture which sees itself as a social movement.
Yeah.
The counterculture of the 60s and 70s was a rather utopian movement that felt, we are changing the world,
right,
by existing. Whereas at this point, there's no similar large-scale community. And basically, independent artists, they self-publish, or they find a publisher willing to sell things, and then there are individual people operating on their own who want to buy them. And it's much more catch-as-catch-can. It's much harder to make any serious money.
Right.
But people who are dedicated to the art form will still do it.
Right.
And there are some success stories. But it's not the same, because the underground comics were specifically related to the counterculture, a movement, the hippie movement.
Yeah. I regret that is no longer with us, to tell you the truth.
Right.
Yes, yes. Let's talk a little bit about your private life, if I may. You wrote something, meanwhile, the dynamics of my personal life took a turn for the better when I fell in love with a lifelong New Yorker named Ed Sederbaum, with whom I've shared my life ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So this was mid-70s?
We met in 79.
Uh-huh.
So we've just hit our 30th anniversary.
Right, and they said it wouldn't last.
And they said it wouldn't.
So 30 years later, and you are living in Western Massachusetts.
Exactly.
And you and Ed and your dog.
That's right.
So domestic tranquility.
Who is being amazingly quiet.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So are you living the dream?
Let's see now. Which dream is that? we are now, I just reached Social Security age.
Uh-huh.
And I'm now concentrating on my cartooning. I was teaching for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm living one kind of dream. I would love to be living it in a time when the economy of the country was not in the pit.
Yeah.
But it hasn't. That hasn't impacted me as much as it has many people, because I'm not dependent on a job.
Right.
So we enjoy each other's company. I mean, although we did get married under Massachusetts law.
Oh, good for you! Congratulations.
Several years ago. But it didn't really change our relationship. And essentially our relationship is built around the fact that we enjoy each other's company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been entertaining to live together all these years, because it hasn't been a static process. I mean, Eddie was with me during the whole gay comics coming out process, mm-hmm. during the whole time I was doing Wendell, the whole time I was doing Stuck Rubber Baby, and the time since. So he's seen me go through a lot of different changes. And meanwhile, he was a social worker when I first met him. And then he went through a period of being a freelance book editor, and then he became a lobbyist for the hate crimes bill in New York City, and then he founded a senior citizen center for gay seniors, and then he ran for the New York State Senate. And he's had a varied career that's been entirely interesting. So I think one of the dangers to a long-term relationship is if it is static, if
yes,
the people
that's
remain
so true.
The same after year.
That's so very true. In the time that we have left, left, I'd like to go back and talk a little bit more about your graphic novel, Stuck Rubber Baby. Why that after, you know, the success you had with like Wendell and the other more comic-y comics?
Mm-hmm. Well, Wendell, I had ended Wendell before the possibility of doing Stuck Rubber Baby arose.
Uh-huh.
I ended Wendell for assorted reasons. It was what I was paid for. It was not keeping up with inflation.
Yes.
I was felt myself going in the hole mm-hmm. with that. And also,
this is labor-intensive and time-intensive.
It's very labor-intensive. This is something that it's very hard to make enough money doing comics to pay for the time it takes, particularly if you are a relatively slow drawer like
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion of graphic novels as a serious medium of expression had been in the air for a number of years when I stopped drawing Wendell in 1979. And in the back of any artist's mind who was involved in comics was, what would it be like to do a graphic novel, and would I be able to do one?
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't seem possible economically to take that much time. But then I discovered, a friend of mine told me that at DC Comics they had established this division, which at the time was called Piranha Press, a sub-imprint of DC Comics, which was devoted to experimental things. And I made contact with the editor there and discovered, to my somewhat surprise, that he was entirely interested in seeing if there was a way that we could do a book.
Mm.
And he asked me if I were to do a graphic novel, what would I like it to be? And that caused me to reflect on some things in my own life that felt that they would be nicely different from Wendell. I didn't want to cover the same ground
right.
as Wendell, because one wants new challenges. And one of the formative experiences of my life was back during my college days, when I was very conflicted about being gay and was trying to be straight and was in a relationship with a girl, and we accidentally got pregnant.
Wow.
And so then we had to deal with what to do then, and essentially we wound up, we didn't want to opt for abortion. Not for ideological reasons, but because this was probably going to be the only child I would ever have.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, it seemed like a recipe for disaster for us to try to get married, since she knew I was gay.
Mm-hmm.
So we opted for giving the child up for adoption,
mm-hmm.
and which is what Toland does in the book.
Uh-huh.
So the most autobiographical part of the book is that portion. Toland Polk is this young guy struggling with his gay impulses, who's trying to be straight and winds up getting his girlfriend pregnant, and they essentially come to the same conclusion. But that felt a little thin for a whole book and a little too in danger of being a soap opera. So I was thinking of what else could be folded into that, and I thought about the culture of Birmingham and all the drama of being part in the middle of that civil rights era. And so that allowed me to move beyond the sort of self-referential themes of the tortured guy, gay mm-hmm. guy trying to come out,
mm-hmm.
Which by that time the gay liberation movement had spawned a lot of coming out novels.
Right, exactly that.
And I didn't want to do just another one of those. And also I was very concerned about racism in America during the 1980s and the resurgence of racism, as well as the emergence of a culture of selfishness that was frightening to me as the product of a somewhat idealistic culture in the 60s and 70s. And I felt the need to remind the world that there were people who were not cynical and who made great sacrifices and took great risks for purposes other than, you know, their own welfare.
Right.
And so the civil rights era was a time when that was commonplace. I think you could probably hear Lulu in the background. That means the postal carrier is coming. Anyway, there was so much meat with all of those themes.
Mm-hmm.
The coming out, the experience of being an unintended parent and coming, figuring out how to relate to the civil rights movement, which I was sympathetic to, as is Toland from
yes.
the word go, but I was not taking any risks for.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so, anyway, there was a big ball of wax there that I figured I would not be in danger of not being able to fill up a couple hundred pages
mm-hmm.
With those themes. And so that's what I brought up to this editor, and he was interested. And he said he liked the idea of doing something that did not take place within the gay subculture.
Right.
But I told him it would have to have a gay content, or else I would be seen as a sellout
right.
To the gay movement. So
yeah.
we agreed that it would Toland would be gay. It would have gay sex in it, though not as explicit as in Underground Comics,
mm-hmm.
but that it would also have important straight characters and be the kind of mix that you have in the real world
mm-hmm.
rather than in a subculture.
Mm-hmm. You wrote another thing about this, and you said the letter writer who referred me to others who had tales to tell about the Southern gay subculture of the 1960s as it was experienced by gay men older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up with a wealth of colorful antidotes to ponder, some of which found their way into Stuck Rubber Baby with scarcely any modifications at all. And that struck me because, and this also brings us up back to what we were talking about last week, and that is when we were coming out in the 70s and as products of post Stonewall, I don't want to put any words into your mouth, but I found it almost impossible to understand how gay life was lived in the 40s and 50s, because mm-hmm. that was something different. I mean, and the gay men that I knew that were products of that time had a whole different mindset about homosexuality and being gay and how one is gay and all that from me. And it was as foreign to me back then as probably some young people in our audience, our experience is foreign to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting. Some people, some people have remarked that some of the characters seemed too enlightened about gay things in Stuck Rubber Baby
mm-hmm.
for the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that we used to sit around in that gay bar, and the only thing missing was the sense that we were part of a social movement.
Right.
There was a strong sense that we were an aggrieved culture, an aggrieved portion of the society, and that in many ways we had a better bead on things like how to have a relationship and stuff than straight people did, because mm-hmm. we didn't have a template.
Mm-hmm.
That we had to fit into. We were sort of outlaws from the word go, and so we had to find our own ways to lead our lives. And this was both an opportunity for great creativity, and in the case of people who, had to deal with a great deal of self-hatred, it was sort of a way to be miserable with a lot of company. And
it was so true. Oh, my gosh.
So basically, I'm glad that I experienced at least the last few years of that pre-Stonewall culture, because it was very interesting to see survival skills in action.
Yes.
And to appreciate really how courageous many people had to be out at whatever level of out they were.
What an affront to the popular culture that was at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a complete affront. It wasn't just like how campy or how fun or here's, the token, gay folk, that was kind of laughed about and, chucked on the shoulder and said, aren't you charming? It was an affront to everything that the
right.
society held sacred.
And there were teenagers who felt like a good kind of fun to have on a Saturday night was to go beat up gay people.
That's so true. Absolutely.
And unfortunately, that has not gone away completely. It's diminished, but not
yes.
gone away, as the Matthew
right.
Shepard episode reveals, and
right.
since then have revealed.
Yes.
But it's at least there is a counter there are counter influences. People today do not look around the world and say, where are any other gay people?
Yes.
They're on TV, they're pop singers, they are, you know, all sorts of role models. Whereas I had precious few role models. I think Allen Ginsberg was an important role model for me because he showed that you could be openly gay and not be shunned by the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very encouraging for me.
Right. It's a very interesting kind of thing.
When I was doing Sucker for Baby, I was very aware that I was coming from, at those days, from a very particular, you know, age experience, and also it was the opposite of with gay comics. I was writing about the Black Civil Rights Movement without being Black,
right.
And I felt on very shaky ground there, being a white Southerner, and so I felt it was important to gather the testimony of African Americans who had been part of that. I made a special effort to talk to Black people in Birmingham who had been around the Civil Rights Movement, who had been activists, who could tell me a little bit about that frame of mind. Because although I was on the periphery of the Civil Rights Movement, I was not myself an activist.
Right.
But I knew activists. So the person on whom the character of Ginger was based had an eye-opening effect on me the way Ginger does on Toland.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of had close brushes with it, but without really taking risks for it.
Yes.
And I wanted to know what was it like to take those risks. And so, you know, people like those Black people and people like those older gay people gave me perspectives so that my book would have a broader perspective than just of that of one guy who was in his 20s when all of that was going on.
Right. And I'm afraid that our time is up, and I as I said last week, I could go on and on with you. It's such a wealth of information and a historical perspective that often is missing for a lot of people, supposedly, or no doubt in our audience. So I thank you very much for taking so much of your precious time to spend with us and to talk about your work and the world that gave it birth. Before we go, thank you. Before we go, could I ask you to give us your web address again and walk us around?
Okay, well, the web address is howardcruz.com, and be sure and spell Cruz correctly, C-R-U-S-E. Don't get Tom Cruise in your mind. And if you go there, you can go everywhere else in the website. It's a very big website. I have a blog, which I update every few weeks. It tells about what my life is like these days, but there's also a lot of my old comics site and various stuff. I sort of originally conceived of the site as a place where you could have the experience of, gee, you know, here's this cartoonist, I read his work, and now I'm invited into his home to chat and see what he's like in the everyday world. And that's what, you know, part of the site is for. And so people are welcome to come in and look around.
Thank you. And thank you for being such an open book. I, from my point of view, you are a national treasure, and I am so grateful that you spent so much of your time with us. And until we chat again, we will be seeing each other in cyberspace.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Howard. Bye. Hey, fantastic show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. I'm so glad you could join me. Tune in next week for more sex advice with an edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is So Hard. I know what you're thinking. With so many herbal supplements on the market that boast fast-acting results, it's hard to know which erection-enhancing formula to choose, or if one shouldn't just avoid them altogether. I always tell my clients to beware of bogus claims and the dangerously adulterated products that abound in the marketplace. So Hard is different. It's made of 100% herbal extracts. It is as effective as any medically prescribed drug I've tested, but it's much kinder to my system. There are no headaches, no unsightly flushes, upset stomach, rise in blood pressure, or altered vision. In my years-long search for the holy grail of herbal erection enhancers, I have found only one product that consistently delivers on the promises it makes without any of the nasty side effects. SoHard improves genital blood circulation, which assists in achieving and sustaining a strong erection.
It's like, you know, I pick you up, I take you out, I bring you home, we say goodnight, and you never kiss me.
What do you say I kiss you really hard on the mouth once we're finished with the show? But first, as you know, every human body is unique, and each of us metabolizes what we consume in a slightly different way. So keep this in mind when you use SoHard. And just so that we're clear, SoHard is not miraculous. It will not override an unhealthy lifestyle. But it can positively affect our sexual response cycle, making us more easily aroused as well as more energetic lovers. Look for the SoHard banner on DrDickSexAdvice.com. And look for all of Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section, obviously, under Health Subcategory Sexuality. Or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe. Leave a comment when you do. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.